post-secondary education is expensive, like really expensive. Many students get help from their parents, but even a maxed out RESP isn't enough to cover tuition, books, housing, all that kind of stuff. So it's no surprise that a lot of students graduate with crippling debt. A report for the Canadian Federation of Students a couple years ago put the total student debt in this country at something like $28 billion. Now, there is a new model of educational funding being tested out in the United States. It's called an income share agreement. And there is now at least one Canadian school that has launched its own program. Economist Lina Nazareth is here to talk more about ISAs and whether this new model has potential here in Canada. Hello there, Linda.
Hey, Bruce.
HackerU is the Canadian entrant here. They launched in Canada just recently. Tell us about how income share agreements work.
Well, the idea here is that you share some of the risk. So if you decide to go to university, you rack up this huge debt, you hope you get a job. In the meantime, you have to keep paying back the money, and maybe you're not making that much, and you may have some unemployment, you're still on the hook for it. So there's a lot of risk. What if you take on this huge debt and it's never worth your while? The idea with the income sharing agreement is, supposedly, it shares some of the risk. The way it works is you borrow the money, and then you pay back a percentage of your earnings. So when you're earning less, you pay less. When you're earning more, you pay more. And over time, you get it paid off based on what you're bringing in. So it's sort of appealing. It takes a little bit of the risk down. Obviously, there are some downsides, though.
Yeah, we will talk about the downsides because I see the pros. I think the cons are the ones that are more complex here. But before we do that, I just want to have you highlight some of the differences between Canada and the U.S. because it seems to make more sense in America, where an undergrad can be like $100,000 a year, whereas here in Canada, even if you're in a high-priced commerce program, it's like $20,000. It's a fifth the cost.
That's true, Bruce. But, you know, depending who you are, $20,000 can be a lot of money, right? That's certainly more than people are making in a summer or whatever it is. So it can be appealing in that sense. Also, there is, I guess, some potential to use this for graduate programs, which are obviously much more expensive.
Yeah.
Actually, some undergrads are much more expensive, too. Business programs and engineering can be much more than, you know, the lower price.
Yeah. So on the pro side, it may be a way to fund your education. It certainly is a different and creative approach. What are some of the cons from your standpoint?
Well, you know, it's debt. It's debt, money you borrow that you will have to pay back. And the way this works is you could end up paying more back than you would have under a conventional plan. Because suppose the first year out, you're making not that much, say $30,000. You're paying, say, 4% of that. Okay, well, that's manageable. Doesn't sound that high. Within a few years, what if you go up to $100,000? You're still paying 4% of that. It's a much higher number. But you're on the hook to pay this percentage of your income for, say, 10 years or whatever it is.
Well, this part really surprised me because I looked at the case study for HackerU, and their tuition was something like $17,000. But based on your income, you could end up spending more than two times that tuition amount if you were earning lots of money.
Which is still not a bad idea, because suppose you don't do it. You may not end up earning much money at all, right? So, you know, here's the deal. They're letting you in and they're putting you on a track to be pretty high paid professional, which you wouldn't have had anymore otherwise. But you're taking the risk. Now, the other way to look at this is it's a little bit like having a fixed rate mortgage. If you take a variable rate mortgage, you probably end up paying less, but your interest rate is going to change from time to time. A lot of people can't sleep knowing
this
is the same thing.
It seems like, especially in the HackerU case, so this is really the only one that I've looked at here on this side of the border, it seems like unnecessary insurance, though, given that they're training them to work in a field in which there are jobs galore, at least for the minute. Is that really, it just doesn't seem like there's going to be a risk that they're not going to be able to get a job.
Well, I think there's always a risk, but you're right. And I think that's something people need to think about, whether they want to take this on or not take this on. I'm not sure how easy it is, though, for some of the kids going in to get those loans. I think the rules around student loans can be quite stringent in some cases, right?
One of the great things about your perspective is that you really do come to all these, you know, micro questions with a big picture perspective. Where does an ISA fit in some of the big questions about educational funding here in this country, policy as it relates to funding our institutions? Where does this fit? Is this a big idea?
Yeah, it's an interesting way to put it. It's not a big idea. It's a way to think about things more creatively, as you said earlier. I think we have to think beyond the norm, right? We had four-year degrees and ways to finance them and a certain number of government programs. Now I think we have to think of education as something else, as maybe something you continuously get. The way the ISAs became popular is really through some of the coding boot camps in the U.S., and that's fine. Like, that's a different kind of education and maybe a different kind of model, and maybe that's something that the larger universities want to adopt. So I talk a lot about this because I mostly am out speaking to groups about the future of work. My latest book is called Work is Not a Place, which tells you how I view all of this. And I think it's about a lot of micro solutions, not one blanket one, but a lot of change and turmoil for workers and a lot of different solutions in terms of what you study and how you pay for it.
What do we know about who makes the money here? Because obviously they're freeing up a pool of capital in which they will invest in these students, coders, or whatever field they pursue. And I presume they have a return on equity that they require. I'm not even sure who the they is in the U.S. Are these hedge funds? Are they wealthy individuals? Who's putting forth the cash to enable these programs to even work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I looked at it, too. I wrote about this in the column for the Globe and Mail. The big university using this is Purdue University in Indiana, and I believe they're using a third party. I don't think the school's making a profit, but somebody's coming in as a facilitator here. When it comes to the coding boot camps, I'm not sure that it is a third party. I think in some cases it is the school themselves because they're for-profit institutions. So they're for profit the same way. You know, if you research this, and I was reading some of the different viewpoints on it, some of the personal finance experts will say, look, it's still debt. Try not to take it on if you can. Try and find ways to self-finance as you go through if you possibly can, because this is still debt with an interest rate attached to it that you will be paying off for a long time, however you do it. So think pretty carefully before you take it on.
You and I are both parents. Your daughter is older than mine, so you're closer to the point where she's going to be drawing down that RESP that I'm sure you've been saving for a very long time. How do you apply an economic lens to what she may pursue or my daughter may pursue after they're finished high school? Is it do what you love and the money will follow, or does your economic and economist background come to the forefront and you say, I don't know how we fund a four-year degree in, I don't know, oil painting or something extraordinary like that?
You know, I definitely do not think in terms of training anybody for a job, because the jobs that we have right now are jobs that are going to disappear. We were just talking about how long we've known each other, Bruce. It's a matter of decades at this point.
Yes.
When we started, people were not making a big living on YouTube. You couldn't get rich that way. And yet now that's what people are doing. There's a whole host of occupations that didn't exist way back when. So I'm pretty wary about saying you have to study and do something specifically. I think you have to study. I'm not sure I would finance every degree that's out there, but I think as long as you have the right skills, which are not necessarily things you learn directly from college or university, you're fine. And what do I mean by that? I mean adaptability. I mean the ability to communicate. I mean the ability to manage people and have good skills at that. Organizational skills, some of which you can learn from school and you will learn from school. Then I think you're in a good position, because I don't think your daughter or mine are necessarily going to start at the job at 22 or 23 or 24 and be doing that for decades.
Yeah. So to our listeners out there who are wondering what Linda is referring to, she and I were both on the founding staff of what is now BNN Bloomberg back in September of 1999. So that
is, We were pioneers.
We launched it and it's still out there doing good in the world. Well, very interesting perspective, Linda. I really appreciate you taking the time to share it with us.
Good talking to you, Bruce.
Linda Nazareth is an economist, an author. She's got a new book out. Our conversation was about these income share agreements, more popular in the U.S. than Canada, but we'll see if they come to be a big thing here.